Hi, and welcome to another edition of Capturing Christianity. Today I have a really interesting show for you. Today we're going to be discussing William Lane Craig's moral argument. If you don't know by now, Capturing Christianity, it's a ministry aimed at exposing the intellectual side of Christianity. There's a pun in there for you. Over the past few months, I've been hosting these discussions on YouTube between Christians and atheists on various topics related to Christian apologetics. And the discussion I have planned for you today is going to be a really fun discussion. It's on, like I said, William Lane Craig's moral argument. And Wade is going to be introducing that for us here very soon. But today discussing, I have Jeffrey J. Lauder. He's our atheist interlocutor. We have Wade Tisthammer. He's our Christian guest. And so like I said, we'll be discussing the moral argument, Craig's moral argument. But before we get to that, I want to give you a couple different ways to get in touch if you want to speak with me or get in touch, recommend a future show topic, anything like that. The way to do that, first of all, is to just subscribe on YouTube. If you're watching on YouTube, just hit the subscribe button there. The website, capturingchristianity.com, is where all the magic happens. If you want to find us on Facebook, facebook.com/capturingchristianity, Twitter @capturingchrist. Email, if you want to email me, if you have a recommendation on a guest that you'd like to see or a topic, email me at capturingchristianity@gmail.com. So yeah, and with that out of the way, we're going to turn directly over to Wade, and I'm going to let him take hold of the, he's got a little presentation planned here, so I'm going to let him do that. And again, sorry about the technical difficulties. I'm having a little bit of feedback on my mic, so I'm going to try to work on that while he's presenting.
All right, y'all ready? Can you see my screen? Could you see it? Are you guys ready?
Yeah, I can see it. I can see myself too.
Okay, good. Then I will begin. All right, so this will be about William Lane Craig's moral argument. His argument goes like this. If God does not exist, then objective moral values and duties do not exist. Premise two, objective moral values and duties do exist. Conclusion, therefore God exists. Now, I'll be arguing for the first premise, but in my opinion, Craig does not do a very convincing job arguing for the first premise. So I'll be justifying the first premise in a bit differently from what he does. First, the terms. Moral objectivism is that moral truths hold independently of our belief and perception of them. So, for example, it's morally wrong for a man to torture an infant just for fun, and it would remain wrong even if baby torture thought otherwise and killed everyone who disagreed with him. Now, we have a couple different types.
Hey, Wade, it looks like we lost you on the microphone.
In school, if you you need to study to do well in school.
Hey, hey, Wade.
Yeah.
We had you cut out on your microphone, so sort of back up to where you were just getting into describing what the descriptive ought is.
Okay, so it's that type of thought that is nothing more than some purely descriptive state of affairs. An example is when, if you want to do well in school, you ought to study just means, as a matter of practical necessity, you need to study to do well in school. It's any type of thought that has no properties besides purely descriptive ones. Prescriptive thought, in contrast, it's not a descriptive thought. It prescribes and is not purely descriptive. Like, you should not torture infants just for fun. People usually have that prescriptive ought sense there. And so the moral ought in William Lane Craig's moral argument and standard conversation generally is a prescriptive ought. It's false that the moral ought has no properties besides purely descriptive ones. So, for example, an action is morally obligatory for someone only if they ought not to do it in a prescriptive ought sense. I mention this because some non-theists define the moral ought to be descriptive ought. So, for example, an atheist might point out that, you know, if God doesn't exist, there are still objective facts about human flourishing. Well, yeah, but that's not what the argument is about. It's about that more metaphysical prescriptive ought type that seems unlikely to exist if atheism is true. So another point that he makes clear in his writing is the type of morality he's talking about is non-natural. Well, natural facts are those that can be expressed in entire language of psychology and natural science, physics, chemistry, and so forth. So natural facts are purely descriptive in nature. I see you made a typo there. The prescriptive ought is by definition not identical to some purely descriptive state of affairs. What that means is that moral oughts are non-natural in the sense that moral ought facts are not natural facts. So there's an argument for that. All natural facts are purely descriptive. Moral ought facts are not purely descriptive. It is false that moral oughts have no properties besides purely descriptive ones. Therefore, moral ought facts are not natural facts. So why is this important? Well, one reason this makes moral properties empirically detectable barring the supernatural. So imagine a moral nihilist and a moral realist observes some jerk kicking a dog just for fun. The dog whimpers in pain and runs away. Both agree on all the physiological and psychological effects, like the dog felt pain and suffered minor injury. Now, moral nihilist says, I don't think moral oughtness, like moral wrongness, is attached to that action. Moral realist says, I think moral oughtness is attached to that action. There is no empirical way to determine who is right, because both views are empirically identical. They agree on all the same empirically observable facts. Now, to justify the premise one of the moral argument, I'll argue that objective morality's existence is unlikely if God does not exist. The rationale behind it is because it's a theorem of mathematics and propositional logic that given A, probably C entails probably if A, then C. So objective morality is unlikely on atheism entails probably if atheism is true, then objective morality does not exist. That's the type of justification I'll be giving here. And if you want to see the theorem, I have it on my blog. Because I'm a math minor, I can do that. So to better understand the reasoning for why objective morality is unlikely on atheism, imagine an unbiased atheist who, prior to examining the data, has no preconceived opinions about whether objective morality exists. Prior to examining the data, she has no intuitions for or against morality's existence. Hopefully, reasoning what the unbiased atheist would conclude about morality's existence will mitigate our own biases in judging how likely morality exists on atheism. And my claim is that the unbiased atheist would be justified in concluding that objective morality probably does not exist. So here it is, basically. If the unbiased atheist would be justified in believing that, you know, not M given A and K, where A is atheism is true, K is the background knowledge. Oh, I see, forgot to include that there. But K is the relevant background knowledge. All right, so support for premise one. The probability that not M, given A and K, A being atheism, K being our background data, is high. I'm going to try to argue that the unbiased atheist would be justified believing that objective morality does not exist given atheism or background knowledge. The type of probability would be the objective evidential relation between data and theory. So let's look at what our unbiased atheist data is. One is that there is zero empirical evidence for objective morality. That's not surprising because moral oughtness, as I mentioned before, is empirically undetectable. So you can't really have empirical evidence for it, at least barring any supernatural intervention. So another thing that the unbiased atheist knows is that objective morality is queered. And I'm going to unpack that a little bit. So to illustrate the idea behind it, imagine the claim that an invisible unicorn is floating above my head. That's possible, but not plausible. I'd be justified in disbelieving in this unicorn. The unicorn is queer enough to be prima facie implausible, and we're prima facie justified to disbelieve it. It's different. It's wildly different in a way to make it unlikely. Objective moral oughtness likewise seems queer. So atheist philosopher J.L. Mackey thinks prescriptive objective moral values would be qualities or relations of a very strange sort, utterly different from anything else in the universe. Correspondingly, if we were aware of them, it would seem to be by some special faculty that is utterly different from our ordinary ways of knowing everything else. So here's why they're queer. They're invisible, non-physical, and empirically undetectable, exist somehow independently of our perception of it. Seems like we'd need something like supernatural clairvoyance to know they exist. I'll go into that a little bit later. Queerness is arguably akin to invisible, non-physical deity from the perspective of the unbiased atheist, who, remember, doesn't have any of these intuitions that objective morality. Okay, yeah, it's akin to visible, non-physical gods. So another thing she knows is that evolution occasionally gives false beliefs, like gods. Moral beliefs have survival value, whether true or not. You know, if they get us to behave in the right ways, they're conducive for species survival. And people would have moral beliefs even if morality did not exist, barring supernatural intervention. Now, here's why that's important. In practice, we believe morality exists on the basis of intuition. It just seems true to us that torturing innocent sentient life just for fun is morally wrong. Barring supernatural forces, we'd have the intuition to form morality's existence, even if morality did not exist. So why is that true? Remember, moral oddness is not natural. And anything outside the natural world causing stuff to happen in the physical world would, by definition, be supernatural. Now, to illustrate why this is important, suppose a cyborg knows she has a metal-detecting implant installed in her brain that's designed so that when a widget is in her hand, the implant delivers a strong intuition that the widget contains metal, if and only if it contains metal. The metal-detecting implant, however, malfunctions such that it would deliver the intuition that the widget contains metal, regardless of whether the widget contained metal. So again, the cyborg would have the intuition that the widget contains metal, even if it did not contain metal. So even if the widget in her hand did contain metal, and she believed it contained metal on the basis of her intuition, that intuition would not deliver a warrant for her belief. And philosophy warrants us that stuff you add to true belief to get knowledge, like some type of evidence or justification added to belief to get knowledge. So even if she believes that it contains metal, she doesn't really know it contains metal, because her intuition would deliver the idea that it would have metal. She'd have the intuition even if it did not contain metal. In the cyborg scenario, whereby the implant supplies the intuition that the widget contains metal, regardless of whether such metal existed, the cyborg's intuition clearly does not deliver a warrant for the metallic widget belief. Similarly, on the atheism scenario, whereby atheism is true and our brains would supply moral intuition regardless of whether morality existed, our moral intuition would not deliver a warrant for morality's existence. Now imagine our unbiased atheist knows that. She wants to determine, okay, people are claiming that this morality exists, but I don't have any empirical evidence for it. It seems queer in a way to make it unlikely to exist. In the absence of any evidence for it, it seems unlikely that it exists. And I know that evolution occasionally gives false beliefs, like gods. Moral beliefs have survival value, whether true or not. And people with this claim that morality exists, they believe it on the basis of intuition, but they'd have the intuition even if morality did not exist. And so it seems like the unbiased atheist would be justified in thinking that, like intuitions of gods existing, intuitions for morality are probably delusory, not veridical. So I do think that the unbiased atheist would be justified in concluding that objective morality probably does not exist. Why? Because given atheism, that's where the evidence points. The evidence suggests that objective morality probably doesn't exist. That is, the probability of morality not existing, given atheism and our background knowledge, is high. So if the unbiased atheist would be justified in believing that not M given A and K is high, then not M given A and K is high. Premise two, the unbiased atheist would be justified in believing that it's high, therefore it's high. And the second part is, yeah, you can read that. If given not M, given A and K is high, then given atheism, moral oddness probably doesn't exist. But of course, because of that theorem I mentioned in P4, I mentioned that theorem. In the first premise, the moral argument is probably true. Conclusion, the first premise, the moral argument is probably true. Now, if you're wondering what the relationship between oddness and values is, moral values seem to be something that, we ought to value. There's at least some possible circumstance in which they ought to be valued, because they ought not to be valued. If it's not the case that we ought to value them, they don't seem to be moral values in how we ordinarily understand the term. And so, that is it in a nutshell.
Okay, so there's a ton of information there that we can look at, but before we do that, I wanted to turn it over to Jeff and see. Well, first of all, let's see if we can agree. And wait, if you could just mute your microphone there. Let's see, Jeff, if we agree on this understanding of the moral obligations in play here. He's talking about the descriptive versus the prescriptive ought. Are we on the same page here about what these oughts are about?
For the most part, yes. There's a couple of tweaks that I would make. They may be more than tweaks. We'll find out. But at the very least, I agree more than I disagree. So,
okay. Now, did you want to sort of attack any of his presentation, or did you want to just go ahead and present yours and then go from there? I'm sort of leaving it up to you.
I think I'd like to just present a few diagrams that aren't necessarily even a direct attack, but or rebuttal. But I feel like there's a step that should come first, which is trying to think of how to phrase this. Introducing some more terms for our background knowledge for our discussion. I'm not even sure that Wade would necessarily disagree with anything I'm about to say. He might, I'm not sure. But I think it would be valuable for the audience, at the very least, to have a better appreciation for the context of this discussion, if you will.
Cool. Yeah, so I'm definitely open to that. If you want to introduce some more clarification on the terms and everything being used, so yeah, feel free.
Okay, so this is not a formal presentation, as soon as I get my mouse over to the other monitor. I threw it into PowerPoint just to make it a little bit easier to navigate, but let me get into presentation mode here.
By the way, does anyone know why the presentation mode is so tiny off in the corner? It's like, shouldn't it be like a big button up in the top right? That's just a personal thing.
Are you seeing?
I always wondered that.
Are you seeing my speaker's view where you can see all the slides at the bottom of the screen, or do you just see a single slide?
So I see the speaker's view. I don't see just one big screen. I see.
This is my biggest complaint about PowerPoint, is it always wants to do everything backwards. Okay, you know what? We're gonna bag that view, and we'll go this way. So,
click on the slideshow tab.
Yeah.
Well, when he did that, it showed on the other screen, is what he's saying.
I think it's got my monitors reversed, and it wants to Google wants to share the wrong monitor.
Yeah, I think if you zoom in there, then we can see everything that we need to see. At least I can. So why don't we just roll with that, and go ahead.
Okay. Is this the same as before?
It's a little bit worse. Click on the from the beginning button or from current slide button on the upper left corner.
Yeah, that's what I did. Okay, let's just skip that. We'll go, we'll do this. Okay, so I will just manually zoom in. I'm sorry for the inconvenience.
No worries. I mean, we can still see everything, so.
Okay, so the first thing is when we talk about metaphysics, what I like to simplify it into thinking about what is reality, what actually exists. And I divide reality into two categories, what I call causal reality and acausal reality. Causal reality is things that exist that can stand in causal relations to one another. So, for example, a volcanic eruption can cause an ash cloud to appear over a volcano. An earthquake can cause a big hole to appear on the ground. Those are physical events causing other physical events or states of affairs. So I call that physical reality. There's also the concept of mental reality, which would be things like consciousness, thought, beliefs, intentions, that sort of thing. I think that Wade and I agree that causal reality exists. We agree that physical things exist, and we agree that mental things exist. The difference between theists and naturalists, as I define the word naturalism, is in what the theist versus the naturalist thinks has ontological priority. So a naturalist is really a source physicalist. A source physicalist believes that the physical has ontological priority over the mental. Another way to think of that is by this slogan. The physical exists, and if the mental exists, the physical explains why the mental exists. In contrast, the supernaturalist is really a source idealist, and that's captured, that means that they think that the mental has ontological priority. And so the slogan would be, the mental exists, and if the physical exists, the mental explains why the physical exists. Classical theism would be one specific version of source idealism, because it says you've got one mental entity, who's not really an entity, but a person, God, who explains why all of physical reality exists. So that's That's the difference. Whereas on source physicalism or naturalism, the naturalist would say that either the universe is eternal, which doesn't appear to be the case based on all the evidence that we have, or it's existed for a finite amount of time. But regardless, in either scenario, there was a substantial period of time where there was nothing mental. Nothing mental existed until matter coalesced into atoms, and there were galaxies and stars and planets, and ultimately evolution kicked in and intelligent life evolved into embodied living organisms. And if naturalism were true, there might not have been any mental things at all. It could have just been a completely inanimate, sterile universe. Likewise, on supernaturalism, there could have just been one or a billion supernatural beings who basked in their own eternal glory and didn't bother to create a physical reality. But if they did exist, if physical reality did exist, they would be behind it. So that's the concept of causal reality.
So I think I'm following you there on that distinction between the two. And I've seen that with other naturalists. Sorry to interrupt you. I've seen that with other naturalists. There's a couple people that we've had on the show before, and they've made that distinction between the logical priority of either physicality or physics or nature. What's logically prior? Is it mental or is it physics in the natural world? And so I think I'm tracking with you there, but I don't want to take too much time unless this is all very, very necessary for your argument, which I'm sure that it is, but I would just like to see if we could get to the part where this is relevant to the moral argument.
Okay, so the other part of reality, and this is relevant, is acausal reality. Philosophers will talk about abstract objects. I'm renaming that to acausal reality. So one position in metaethics is what William Lane Craig would call moral Platonism. If there are objective moral values existing as abstract objects, they would exist in acausal reality. So the very first point is that atheism by itself simply says there is no God. It doesn't say there is no acausal reality. And even naturalism simply says there are no supernatural beings. It doesn't say there is no acausal reality. So to the extent that we may have reason to believe that acausal reality exists or we're agnostic about it, including atheism or naturalism in our background knowledge wouldn't change the status of an acausal reality. Let's see if I can get my computer to cooperate. The next diagram, I think I may have gotten ahead of myself. I'm going to skip that slide because it's not essential. So the next thing I want to talk about is the concept of moral ontology. Am I doing okay? Craig talks a lot about an ontological foundation for moral values, and I think I understand what he means, and I think that a lot of atheists seem to be hardwired to misunderstand what he means, and I'm not sure why that is, but it's as if people don't get it. When he says that there are objective moral values, as I understand him, he's saying that there are moral values that are ontologically objective. And so what does it mean to have an ontologically objective moral value? I think of it in terms of truth makers. What makes a moral value true or exist? So if you say, for example, that honesty is objectively morally good, in an ontological sense, what you would be asking is what makes it the case that honesty is objectively morally good? If I say that there is green grass in my backyard, that's an ontologically objective statement because the green grass is out there whether or not I think it exists. And so the concept is that with an ontologically objective moral value, it would exist regardless of what any person thinks about it. We could all think that it doesn't exist or says something different, and we would be wrong. It would still exist. So the interesting question, and this is, I think, directly relevant to both Craig's argument as well as Wade's interpretation and defense of it, is what's the ontological status of moral values and duties? And I think there are two routes that a person could go, not just a defender of the moral argument, but any person. You could be a moral reductionist, where you could say that moral facts and properties ultimately reduce to a non-moral fact and property, either something physical or something mental. Or you could be an anti-reductionist and say that moral values cannot be ontologically reduced to anything non-moral. Moral anti-reductionism, I think, is a better name than what Craig uses, which is moral Platonism. This is the view that was defended not only by Plato, but more recently G.E. Moore, and today by Eric Weilenberg. Again, I think this directly relates, because the atheist or naturalist who is a moral objectivist has two different options for embracing ontologically objective morality. The first is moral to physical reductionism, and the other is moral anti-reductionism. So a moral to physical reductionist could say that, yes, there are ontologically objective moral values, but they reduce to facts about human flourishing, which is something defended by the contemporary philosopher Larry Arnhart. On the other hand, they could say that moral facts are an abstract object. They exist in a causal reality, and they're not reducible to anything non-moral. And so far, the only argument that I've heard, it was kind of hinted at in his presentation. I saw a more explicit defense on one of his blog posts, was the notion that morality is, by definition, tied up with the concept of a prescriptive ought, which I agree with. What I didn't hear him say today, but I've seen him write, is the notion that a prescriptive ought is tied up or presupposes a categorical imperative. And so I think that's one area where we may have a disagreement. I think that probably is one area where we have a disagreement. So I think that there's a debate to be had about whether or not a prescriptive ought, in fact, has to be categorical. And if it doesn't, then I think that moral to physical reductionism is a live option. And then you've got moral anti-reductionism. The other thing I would say is, apart from all of that, I'm not actually sure that the concept of a categorical ought actually makes a whole lot of sense, whether or not God exists. The problem is not that theism can explain categorical imperatives while atheism or naturalism cannot. Rather, the problem is that it's doubtful that the concept of categorical imperatives makes sense on any worldview. I can imagine a world in which God exists. At the same time, I cannot imagine categorical imperatives existing in that world, since the concept of a categorical imperative borders on the unintelligible. What would it mean for categorical imperatives to exist in a theistic world, and how would God add something to categorical imperatives that a godless world lacks? About the only answer I've ever seen to this question is the idea that God will ensure that the demands of morality and the demands of self-interest will coincide. Not only is that dubious, even on the assumption that theism is true, but it also actually seems self-defeating argument, because it seems to reduce categorical imperatives to hypothetical imperatives. It doesn't explain how categorical imperatives could exist at all.
So let me, if you don't mind, I've got a little bit of feedback on yours. Jeff, if you could just mute your microphone real quick, sorry. All right, so what I wanted to do, since this does, it seems like it's going to play a big role in this discussion, let's get clear on what these two terms mean, the categorical and the hypothetical, right? Are those the two terms that we're using here, categorical and hypothetical ought? Let's see if we can get clear on what those terms mean, and then see if that's going to be a necessary component of Wade's argument that he presented here. So whichever one of you guys wants to help us better understand what those terms mean, and then we can focus in on those arguments there. Why don't you go ahead and explain them, Wade?
Oh, me. Well, they're not really my terms, but okay.
Okay. Well, either way, I mean, like I said, either one of you guys, if Jeff,
as how I remember it, is the idea that here's something that you must do independently of your goals, and how Kant described it is that you always ought to do this basically no matter what. He's pretty hardcore that way. And hypothetical imperative is very similar to what I described as my example of a descriptive thought, where, you know, if you want to do well in school, you ought to study, meaning something like, as a matter of practical necessity, you need to study to do well in school. That type of ought is sometimes called a hypothetical ought because it's the ought of a hypothetical imperative. Though to be sure, hypothetical oughts aren't the only types of oughts that are descriptive. You could have the word ought be, you know, some other descriptive meaning. It wouldn't really matter. But what I defined prescriptive ought, it didn't define it as a categorical ought. It's not a categorical imperative. In a way, some philosophers have described moral oughts being categorical in a different way, where it's reason giving independent of one's goals. If we understand a reason as a fact or condition that makes something proper or appropriate to do some action. And that's how you define reason for action, and it's pretty clear because, well, if you prescriptively ought to do something, then then of course it's appropriate and proper to do that action. So it's categorical in that way, but not necessarily in Kant's way, the way he originally described it.
So, Jeff, would you agree with the way that he laid those terms out there? Is that how you were using them?
Yeah, I think I would. On his blog page, he actually made the distinction another way, which I think is also helpful. Instead of categorical versus hypothetical imperatives, I think he also used the alternative terminology of unconditional imperatives versus conditional. So an example of conditional would be, if you want to be healthy, then you ought to exercise on a regular basis. Whereas an unconditional imperative would be, exercise on a regular basis, period, full stop.
Okay, and so your argument is essentially, well, help me if I'm wrong here. It seemed like you were saying that an unconditional ought, this categorical imperative, just seems unlikely on any view that you're looking at, whether it's theism, whether it's naturalism or atheism. It just seems like that's something that can't really exist on any worldview. Is that sort of what you were saying?
That's kind of where I'm at right now is, you know, I've been actually toying with the idea of, if I were in Wade's shoes, could I try to defend a moral argument for Christianity? And while I was thinking about that, or not Christianity, but theism, and while I was thinking about that, you know, I was thinking about the notion of a categorical or unconditional imperative, and I realized that, as I see it, whether or not God exists actually doesn't really make any difference to whether or not there's a categorical imperative. It would be sort of like, whether or not God exists doesn't really make any difference to whether or not 3 + 4 = 5 billion. That's not the case, and your worldview doesn't really have anything to do with that. Similarly, I don't know how to make it work, even if I include theism in my background knowledge, the concept of an unconditional imperative where you always ought to do something, period, not conditional upon anything else. Even if I assume God exists, that actually doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And so that's why I said in my initial presentation, I can imagine God existing. I can imagine being told, I can imagine Christianity being true, and that, you know, if you die and you're saved, go to heaven. And if you're not, something bad happens, you either suffer in hell or you're annihilated or whatever. All of that makes sense. And I can understand the link from all of that to hypothetical imperatives.
This is all really interesting. Well, not to cut you off there, but it sounds like you're saying that there's always going to be some sort of condition, even on theism. So let's explore that just a little bit. So, like, if God commands not to rape, there's going to be some sort of condition that makes that the case. So, like, God commanded it would be the condition or something like that. Is that sort of what you're thinking?
Something like that. So, like, God would, I can envision God issuing commands, whether through the Bible and or, you know, private religious experience, but that doesn't give you a categorical or unconditional imperative. That there's a presupposition there that if you want to stand in a good relationship with God, if you want to love God, if you want to have eternal fellowship with God, then do X, don't do Y. That I get, but I don't see how theism yields or predicts a categorical imperative.
So you don't actually think that these categorical imperatives exist, do you?
I guess I don't, because I'm having a hard time imagining any worldview where they make sense. So this has nothing to do with the fact that I'm an atheist. Pretend that I'm a Christian. I still don't see how you get a categorical imperative.
Okay. Well, Wade, I mean, this is a really interesting discussion. Wade, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, how I define prescriptive ought doesn't really require a categorical imperative in Kant's sense. So that's sort of relevant if that's what you're talking about. If you're talking about categoricity in the sense that it gives me a reason to perform this action, in the sense that it makes it proper or appropriate to do that action, well, that part of it exists. That's just sort of Nate seems to follow from, you know, if we ought to do something, that it's appropriate to do that action. But do you believe in that sort of ought, Jeff?
I was trying to take notes and then unmute the microphone. Yeah, I think I do. I have to think out loud, though. So again, to make it simple and non-question begging, I'll use an example about health. I would say I have reasons to exercise. They're a means to an end of being healthy. I don't know in your book if that counts as the second kind of categoricity or not. Does it?
Okay, so categoricity is something that is moral claims, moral judgments are reason giving independent of what your goals are.
I don't embrace categoricity in that sense.
Okay.
It would be like saying, let me think of a non-moral example. Independent of the fact that you could win $1 billion if you win the Powerball lottery, you have a categorical reason to play the lottery. That doesn't make any sense to me at all. I can see a pragmatic reason, although I'm not a fan of lotteries, but you know, I can see a reason for buying a lottery ticket for the chance of winning $1 billion. But I have no idea what it would mean to say that there's literally an unconditional reason to buy a lottery ticket. I can't think of a way that there could be an unconditional reason to do anything. Maybe I'm not getting it, but that's where I'm at.
Okay, so notice, though, that conditional oughts or hypothetical oughts, those types of oughts are pretty descriptive. They describe reasons for doing some action. And they don't. And the types of reasons are, you know, they describe, you know, if you wanted to do X, you ought to do Y, just meaning as a practical necessity, you need to do X to get Y. Those types of thoughts are entirely descriptive.
So this may be a semantics thing that might not be valuable to spend time on. I actually reject that. I think that, I mean, if you want to call that a descriptive ought and play a language game, that's fine. I would say that it's an ought. It's a prescriptive ought, but it's a conditional prescriptive ought. It's still prescribing what you ought to do, conditional upon some other desire or goal or objective.
Okay, well, remember how I defined the two different types of oughts. A descriptive ought is any type of ought that is nothing more than some purely descriptive state of affairs. An example would be, as a practical matter of practical necessity, you need to study, do well in school. That's a descriptive state of affairs. A prescriptive ought is a type of ought that is not purely descriptive. It is not identical to some purely descriptive state of affairs. Those are how I'm defining my terms. And it's important to understand that when Craig and a lot of other theists, when they talk about morality and moral ought, they're using that prescriptive sense of ought, the type of ought, you know, I mean, that's kind of why Hume had his is ought problem an inquiry concerning human understanding. It's like, how do you deduce an ought from an is? And he specifically had the moral ought in mind. Now, if the moral ought were just it were some purely descriptive state of affairs, well, then driving it would be trivial. But that's why it's a problem in the first place, and that's a type of moral ought. That's a type of ought that the moral argument has in mind in William Lane Craig's case. And that's why moral properties are non-natural on this semantics.
Right. So I'm not actually convinced that there is an is-ought distinction. I think it's actually trickier than a lot of people realize to actually make that work. So let's assume that I say there is a distinction between is and ought, which I think is linked to your the way that you're distinguishing what you call a descriptive ought versus a prescriptive ought. That actually is tricky because you want to be able to make you want to be able to say that there are some propositions that are true that describe a state of affairs regarding oughtness. But if there is truly a hard distinction between is and ought, then you can't do that. And that would actually be, if not self-defeating, it would certainly be undermining your own position. So I think, again, I'm not sure if this is just a preference for a different set of labels or not, you know, or if there's something more more substantial there. As I see it, there are clearly hypothetical or unconditional imperatives, whether or not God exists. I don't see how adding God's existence gives you a unconditional or categorical imperative.
God's omnipotent, so he can do basically anything.
What's that?
Well, God's omnipotent, so he can do basically anything, including making unconditional oughts. I mean, it's not logically impossible.
Well, that raises an interesting question. Is the notion of a categorical imperative actually coherent? If it's not coherent, then could God do that? I'm not so sure. Usually we say that omnipotence is the ability to do anything that is not logically contradictory. So the question is, does the concept of a categorical imperative itself make sense?
You guys are a lot more informed on this than I am, but I wanted to just ask this question real quick. So does any ethicists in the literature, do they argue that categorical imperatives of this kind are logically impossible? Is there any sort of literature on that we could maybe point people to?
I know there's some people who deny that that only oughts that exist are hypothetical oughts. I don't know of any that argue that the categoricity type of thought is logically impossible. I should remind you that I'm not saying that I don't necessarily believe in the categorical imperative as Kant defines it. I mean, I think there are certain oughts that are reason giving independent of one's goals, since that's what the prescriptive ought is. So like, for example, I ought not to torture infants just for fun. Well, that means I have a reason not to do that. I mean, it's appropriate for me not to torture infants just for fun, regardless of what my goals are. I mean, that seems to be characteristic of a prescriptive ought, as most people understand morality, though it's not strictly part of the definition.
Okay. So Jeff, I mean, do you agree with that understanding? It's a reason giving ought, like it gives you a reason when you think. Is it just when you think about it? That's when you have the reason. When you have this sort of moral intuition, that's the thing that's giving you the reason. When you understand the truth of it, how does that work?
Well, how it works is, you know, think of prescriptive ought. You ought to do something. Well, then if you prescriptively ought to do something, then it's proper and appropriate to do that thing. And that's, if you define a reason as something, a reason for an action is something that is a fact or condition that makes it proper or appropriate to do that action, that's a reason for the action. And so prescriptive ought, that does seem to be reason giving in that sense, and that if I have a prescriptive obligation, prescriptively ought to do something, then it's proper and appropriate for me to do that action. Normally, when we think of the moral ought, we do think of it as something that's reason giving in that sense, independently of what our goals are. So, for example, a homophobic bigot, for example, he ought not to commit violent bigotry against someone. Even if not doing that doesn't meet any of his goals, he still shouldn't do it. And in that sense, it does seem to be that moral oughts, as most people understand the term, do seem to be categorical in that sense.
But they're also prescriptive, right? And in the way that you're defining that, it can't reduce to any purely descriptive state of affairs, right?
Right.
And so there's something else, I guess, going on that's making it the case that there's still this ought, even though there's nothing there. You know what I mean?
So here's maybe like a very rough way to understand the distinction between is and ought. Suppose we define descriptive language as any language that doesn't include ought type words or phrases like it, like ought, should, or you are obligated to. We can say that a fact is descriptive if what it means, if what that fact is, can be described in purely descriptive language. So for example, as a matter of practical necessity, you need to do well. You need to study and do well in school. That would be a descriptive fact because you can describe what that fact is without using ought type words or phrases. But we talk about how, like, well, is God needed for morality? Well, that's actually sort of beside the point for the first premise. How I argued for the first premise is that, okay, given atheism, objective morality probably does not exist. You know, given that God does not exist, it's very likely that objective morality does not exist in that prescriptive ought sort of way. Now, as long as you grant that, you're forced by the rules of logic and mathematics to believe that the first premise is probably true. So we haven't heard anything of my interlocutor to dispute that claim.
Yeah, maybe we can turn back to the argument that you gave. And I don't know if you're able to, while I'm speaking, if you can pull up the basic argument for the from the unbiased atheist so that we can take a look at that more clearly. Unless, Jeff, you had something that you wanted to say or clarify.
Whenever you want, I'm ready to respond to that argument.
Okay. Yeah, why don't you go ahead and do that, and then we'll turn to the unbiased atheist argument.
I was trying to take notes as he was presenting the argument from the unbiased atheist. I actually think that his unbiased atheist, if he reasoned that way, would actually be engaging in logically fallacious reasoning. He said that the unbiased atheist would be justified in concluding that objective morality does not exist. His first reason was that there is zero empirical evidence for objective morality. Let's say for the sake of argument that that is true, it wouldn't follow that, it doesn't follow that if there is zero empirical evidence for X, therefore X doesn't exist. That's actually deductively, that's an invalid argument. As an inductive argument, that could sometimes be a correct inductive argument, and other times an incorrect inductive argument. What we have here is really a slogan masquerading as a argument or reason. So if he wants to make an inductive argument that is saying what's the best explanation for the lack of empirical evidence for objective morality, and then show that the best explanation is that it doesn't exist, given certain background assumptions, then he has to actually make that argument. He hasn't made that argument. I don't see, just being honest here, I don't see how he would make that argument work. The second point that he gave, I think, was that objective morality is clear, and he used the J.L. Mackey to support that point. What I would say in response to J.L. Mackey is that J.L. Mackey, if I remember correctly, was a reductive physicalist. And so if you go back to that diagram I presented at the very beginning, J.L. Mackey denied that there exists anything that I call a causal reality. J.L. Mackey denied the existence of abstract objects. Well, all that tells us is that J.L. Mackey isn't a Platonist. That isn't really an argument. Yeah, if you believe that a causal reality does not exist, then heck yeah, objective morality is clear. But if you don't believe the way that Mackey did, if your background information includes the proposition God does not exist, and maybe also includes the proposition no other supernatural beings exist, those propositions, as your background knowledge, do not make objective morality clear because they say precisely zero, zilch, nada, nil, about whether or not an a-causal reality exists. His next reason was that evolution...
It looks like you have your notes there, so let's say that. Let's discuss these two arguments real quick, and then we'll move to the third one. First argument was about the empirical... you can't empirically detect these moral oughts, and so... the unbiased atheist probably would not infer that these moral oughts exist because they're empirically undetectable. And then the second one was because they were queer. And he's saying that Mackey thought that, he was what, a physical a reductionist, right? He didn't think that there were these platonic objects. And so if we include some of that in our background knowledge, then it doesn't really seem necessarily that this is incompatible with atheism. But let's if that was fair, Jeff, of a summary of your arguments. So Wade, let's get your thoughts on those two, and then we'll move to his third.
Okay, I think there might have been some misunderstanding of what I was arguing here, so I'll go here. Okay, so I probably didn't make this sufficiently clear before, but I'm not claiming that each individual premise is enough to justify the conclusion. I do think all of them combined, statements 1 through 5 together, given those, the unbiased atheist would be justified in thinking that, like intuitions of God's existing, intuitions for morality are probably delusory and not political.
Yeah, and I was actually gonna make that same point, but then it seemed like Jeff has an actual objection to each 5, and so it would sort of make sense in the end.
Well, I agree that zero empirical evidence for objective morality by itself isn't enough for the unbiased atheist for the conclusion. The fact that whether Mackey believed in a causal reality, well, that's sort of irrelevant because that's not how I'm arguing for premise 2. My justification for premise 2 has to do with the nature of non-natural moral oughtness. It's invisible, non-physical, empirically undetectable, and somehow exists independently of our perception of it. That to me, from the perspective of the unbiased atheist, that does seem pretty queer. It seems like you need... like, in the absence of some reason to believe it, you need some evidence to believe this moral oddness exists.
Well, I mean, what Jeff seems to be saying is that what this person could do is include in their background knowledge that something like moral Platonism is true. Or it doesn't have to be moral Platonism. It could just be some sort of Platonism. That there are some sort of Platonic objects or facts or propositions or whatever in this Platonic ether. And so that wouldn't necessarily make it to where that... it's incompatible with atheism. Is that sort of what you were saying, Jeff?
I mean, that's part of it. And I recognize he was arguing that he was giving an abductive argument based on, I think there were 5 reasons. So it wasn't his intent to claim that each one by itself does all the heavy lifting. It's all of them taken together. I guess the real point is this, you know, you go through each of his points individually, if you guys want me to do that. I want to say where I'm headed, though, because that might actually help everyone. There's actually a certain part of me that agrees with some of what he said. So to cut right to the chase, my belief is that Craig's moral argument gets it exactly backwards. He emphasizes the fact, as if it were a virtue, that his moral argument is about moral ontology and not moral epistemology. He thinks that the atheist or the naturalist has an ontological problem because there's no room to locate moral facts or properties. But he says the atheist or naturalist can know that objective moral values exist and they can know what's good and bad, right and wrong. I think he's got it completely backwards. So I think ontologically, there is no issue, period. The problem for atheism and naturalism, if it's a problem, actually has to do with skepticism about the existence of objective moral values and maybe what those objective moral values are. So I actually think the best moral argument for theism would appeal to moral epistemology. I think moral ontology is a complete non-starter. When I look at the 5 reasons that Wade gave, I actually, you know, in a sense, I putting some quibbles aside, for the most part, I agree with them taken on their own, but I would draw a slightly different conclusion. The unbiased atheist would not look at his 5 facts and say, therefore, objective moral morality probably doesn't exist. That's not what a logical atheist would do. Instead, the logical atheist would become agnostic, not about God's existence, but about objective morality's existence. They would say, I don't have any empirical evidence for it. I'm hardwired by natural selection. I'm predisposed to believe that morality is objective, whether or not it is. So that acts as a defeater for the fact that it seems like it's objective. There are all these defeaters for the reasons you might give to think that objective morality does exist, but I don't actually have any good reasons to think it doesn't exist. So if I don't have good reasons for, and I don't have good reasons against, the rationally unbiased atheist would say, I don't know if they exist.
your mic is muted. Yeah. Right there.
Part of my argument for my argument from the unbiased atheist recall was that if atheism is true, we don't actually have any warrant for believing that morality exists. That was kind of the point of one of the statements, that, you know, it, we would have this intuition that morality exists regardless of whether it existed. But if that's true, that intuition doesn't deliver warrant for our belief. And so here's one way to look at it. We could have, you know, intuitions of all sorts of crazy things. I could have an intuition that a flying spaghetti monster exists. Now, do I know, you know, out there in space, maybe there's an alien flying spaghetti monster. Now, if people evolved with that intuition, for whatever reason, and we discovered that people would have that intuition regardless of whether a alien flying spaghetti monster existed, you know, what would our assessment of the likelihood of that belief be? Well, you know, if we had to, like, bet, we'd probably get bet against it just because it seems sort of unlikely. I mean, it could happen, but it kind of seems unlikely if we had to guess whether or not it exists. So I guess one disputable point we have is invisible, non-physical, empirically undetectable moral oughtness, you know, how likely is that? Is that queer akin to, say, an invisible unicorn floating above my head? In my opinion, it is, on atheism, queer. It's strange enough to be prima facie unlikely, akin to invisible, non-physical gods. I mean, when you think about it, objective morality is very much like a god, because, you know, what is objective morality? Well, it's this invisible, non-physical component of reality transcending our opinion that says we shouldn't do certain things. That sounds kind of like a deity. So I do think its queerness is at least that akin to that of gods. And so for that reason, I think the unbiased atheist would be justified in thinking that it probably doesn't exist.
So it'll come as no surprise I don't agree. First of all, I think the analogy between objective morality and what was the example you gave, an alien invisible spaghetti monster above my head existing.
Well, invisible unicorn.
Invisible unicorn. An invisible unicorn existing. You know, what that's supposed to make us think that if we're atheists, we should also think that objective morality is absurd. But because I am a Bayesian and a student of Paul Draper and a fan of his theory of intrinsic probability, one of the things I do when I look at metaphysical hypotheses like the existence of irreducible normative truths or the existence of invisible pink unicorns is I look at what is their intrinsic probability. How do you measure intrinsic probability? You look at what does the hypothesis say? Is it modest and is it coherent? An invisible pink unicorn is both immodest and an incoherent hypothesis. If it's invisible, it can't be pink. And if I'm going to have an invisible species, why a unicorn and not a regular horse? Why a horse rather than an amoeba? The fact that it's so specific makes it extremely implausible before we even consider evidence for or against that it exists. In contrast, when we look at something like objective morality, we're not dealing with such hyper-specific claims. We're dealing with things like pain is intrinsically bad. That's a very modest statement. That's the opposite of the specificity. And there's no coherence problems. There's no reason to think that one property of a moral value is in tension with or contradicts another property. So I don't think that analogy works at all. The reason we don't think that invisible pink unicorns exist, yeah, there's no evidence for their existence, but the much more important fact is the fact that they're intrinsically absurd. It's not just that they're intrinsically improbable. The intrinsic probability of an invisible pink unicorn is virtually zero. As for God, I don't think that objective morality is anything like a God. Again, the diagram that I showed at the beginning, God is a causal being. God stands in causal relations, if he exists, with other mental entities, whether they be angels or demons, as well as the physical universe that he created. In contrast, moral properties can't stand in causal relations. They're not even a conscious being. So there are massive differences between God existing and objective morality existing.
I didn't say invisible pink unicorn. I just said visible unicorn. And I wouldn't say that objective morality and God are nothing alike. I mean, they're both non-natural, both invisible and empirically undetectable. And they both have that sort of you ought to behave in a certain way sort of thing in common. So they have, I think they have some similarities. But I mean, even didn't you yourself think that the prescriptive ought, at least when it implies categoricity, is maybe not coherent? Didn't you yourself say that?
Yes, I did.
Well, then wouldn't that type of ought be unlikely, at least given atheism?
That's precisely the wrong way to think about it. If it's just unlikely, period, it's equally unlikely on both theism and atheism. And what I've yet to hear is an explanation of how, I mean, let's assume I'm an evangelical Christian for the afternoon. Okay, I believe the Bible is the inerrant word of God. Now explain to me how that did anything to help out with the notion of a categorical imperative existing. I'm not aware of a biblical command from God that says I have to believe in categorical imperatives. I'm not aware of any theologian saying that certain verses need to be interpreted a certain way. I don't know of any church tradition. So if I add to my background knowledge that the statement that the Bible is the word of God, God exists, how does that in any way help me come to a place where I think categorical imperatives are true?
Well, that's sort of irrelevant to the justification of the premise. It doesn't really affect the truth or justification of either. Well, I mean, I guess it. You could argue that attacks premise too. But let's begin with this. Do you agree with me that given atheism, the likelihood that this prescript of ought exists is low?
No, I don't agree.
So do you believe that it's likely that this prescript of ought exists?
No, I don't believe that either. The key point here is that if you want to talk about the premise...
That's how probability works. Okay, you believe that atheism is true, right?
You said that you want to link your argument from an unbiased atheist to a defense of premise one of Craig's moral argument. The problem is that the conclusion of your argument from an unbiased atheist simply talks about warrants, if I took my notes correctly. So you could say, sure, the atheist is unwarranted in believing that objective morality exists for the sake of argument.
That's not quite what the argument was. The argument was that the unbiased atheist would be justified in believing that morality, that this moral oughtness doesn't exist. Again, just to make sure to identify whether we're on the same page. Now,
okay, so I apologize. I misspoke. So I accept your correction. The conclusion is the unbiased atheist would be justified in, say it again?
In believing that the likelihood of objective morality existing given atheism is low.
Okay, so even with that clarification, that conclusion is different from premise one of Craig's moral argument. So there's still an inferential gap. You have to add another argument to go from your argument from the unbiased atheist to premise one of Craig's moral argument is true. What's the argument?
Yeah, he did give that. Wait, if you can put, do you have that slide available so that we can put up the steps there? Your mic is still muted there. I do remember seeing an argument. Yeah, I do remember seeing a series of steps to that conclusion. So let's see if we can get it up here so we can take a closer look.
All right, you guys see it?
Yeah.
Okay, notice premise two here. P2, the justification for that is, well, okay, so the justification for premise P1 there is that the unbiased atheist, that person is in a good vantage point to evaluate the objective evidential relation between data and theory. Now, the justification for premise P3 has to do with the theorem of mathematics and propositional logic. You know, given A, C is probably true, entails probably if A, then C. So P3 is basically true by definition. I mean, well, it's true by virtue of mathematics and propositional logic. So that's why I tried to ask you earlier, do you agree with me that the likelihood that objective morality does not exist given atheism is, you know, is it likely that objective morality does not exist given atheism? Now, if you believe that this prescript of ought does not exist and you're an atheist, then by the rules of logic, you're committed to accepting this, that the probability of objective morality not existing given atheism is high. So that's why I did that.
So I apologize. I've forgotten that you gave that slide.
Wade, would you mind keeping it up? At least
that's actually helpful.
Okay. Yeah. And your face is beautiful, but I want to see that premise. And so the premise that I would want to take issue with is P1. And I think that's where Jeff is going to take issue with too, but I'm going to let you say what you want to say about it, Jeff.
Okay, got it back on the screen. Thank you. So yeah, I do take issue with P1. And the other thing that's going on here, which I think is kind of strange, is it wants to, what we're seeing on the slide is that there's an attempt to link the implications or the probable implications of atheism for morality to what an unbiased atheist believes, as if what an unbiased agnostic or an unbiased Muslim or an unbiased Hindu or Christian believes would be irrelevant. What we're ultimately interested in is would be whether or not, to use his symbols, is what is the probability of M or not M conditional upon atheism and our background knowledge. And so, yes, I very much dispute the fact that atheism makes objective morality improbable. And this is something I've noticed a lot. There are a lot of people, not just Wade, but a lot of people I think who will make a confusion about what is the unconditional probability of some hypothesis versus what's the conditional probability of the hypothesis on atheism. If its unconditional probability is that it's extremely low, it doesn't matter whether or not it's probable on theism or atheism, just is low.
I think this is one way to maybe that we could look at it. So Wade, do you think that someone can have a justified false belief?
Yes.
Okay. It seems to me that if we grant that, it doesn't necessarily follow that if someone is justified in believing something, that it's therefore true, right? And that's or probably true.
Okay, so the argument for P1 is that the unbiased atheist, you know, we could presume that, you know, that she's an ideally rational agent, but the idea is that her vantage point is a good vantage point to evaluate the objective evidential relation between not M and A and K. So given that, you know, if her cognitive faculties were functioning properly, we assume that she's justified in believing. So A and K is what she knows. That's what she believes, right? And she believes in not M. So if she's justified in believing that not M is true given A and K, you know, that would seem to believe that, you know, she's justified in accepting that. And so, yeah, I guess the only way you can dispute P1 is if you think the unbiased atheist is not a good vantage point from which to evaluate the objective evidential relation between A and K and not M.
And then the objection would move to P2.
Yeah.
Right. And so go ahead.
Okay. We might actually be able to short circuit this a little bit because, I mean, this argument might actually be unnecessary for our purposes because, Jeff, you believe that this prescript of ought probably doesn't exist, right? And you believe that atheism is true?
I believe that I am a skeptic of a categorical imperative in either sense that you've explained it.
So skeptic, you're agnostic or you believe that it probably doesn't exist?
Your microphone is muted, Jeff.
Sorry. I'm unwilling to make the claim that it probably doesn't exist. I guess I'm undecided. I'm probably sounding like I think it doesn't exist, but the fact that I can't think of a way to make it work, I'm not willing to go be bold about it and say therefore it doesn't exist. I guess I'm more agnostic, and that's really I could sum up my objection to P1 is why would the unbiased atheist conclude not M, the probability of no objective morality is high, as opposed to the probability is unscrutable or inscrutable. It seems to me, for the reasons I gave a few minutes ago, that they should be agnostic about whether or not objective morality exists.
Okay, here's maybe another analogy. All right, suppose there's a number between 1 and 100. Somebody guessed it, okay? There's a number in a hat, number 1 through 100. People have the intuition that the number is 75, but they would have the intuition regardless of whether it contained the number. Now, an unbiased observer, shall we say, would conclude that it's probably not 75. Their belief is probably wrong. Now, do they know it with absolute certainty? No, I mean, there's a 1% chance it could be right, but they're justified in believing it's probably not the case. Now, I think, and I think we might disagree here, that from the standpoint of the unbiased atheist, and just given what we know of like physical reality, it's wildly different from the types of things we know exist, in the sense that I suppose it could exist, but, oh, here's another example. Suppose someone says, a flying saucer landed in my backyard. Now, it could be true, but it seems unlikely because it seems different from the types of things we normally encounter. So it seems like, you know, one of those, you know, less than, nothing greater than 1% chance, 1 in 100 thing of that happening. And so it seems from an epistemic point of view, because that's basically what this type of probability is, the objective evidential relation between data and theory, that it's unlikely. But I guess you and I have different intuitive perceptions about how unlikely it is, given that we have no evidence for it, this invisible, non-physical, empirically undetectable stuff that's somehow associated with our action.
Yeah, we do. And I think I really appreciate the examples you give, because I think they illustrate what I'm trying to explain, which is that let's go through those examples. So the first example was that, you know, we're trying to guess some number between 1 and 100. And I or a group of people have a bias that it just is 75. No matter what it actually is, we're predisposed to think it's 75. And you said, but, you know, that's unlikely. There's a 1 in 100 chance that it's a 75. And you didn't use these exact words, but that implies that there's a 99% chance that it's anything other than 75. So in that case, what's doing the work there is not the lack of evidence that it's 75. What's doing the work is literally the chance, the objective chance, using the theorem of indifference, that each possible number is equally likely. And so there's only a 1% chance it's a 75 and a 99% chance that it's not 75. That's what's doing the work, not the lack of evidence. Likewise, with the flying saucer landing in my backyard example, what's doing the real work is not the lack of evidence, but the fact that it conflicts with our background knowledge. The fact that not only do we not have experience of flying saucers landing in our backyard, but we have experience of them not landing in our backyard. Now, I'm not exactly sure how this is supposed to help in the case of objective moralities, because, you know, as an atheist, I certainly believe that there are lines of evidence that are more probable on atheism or naturalism than theism. But I have no idea how I would go from that to the claim that the only thing that exists is the physical. And that's a key point of, I guess that's a key difference between naturalists like me and other kinds of naturalists who will say the physical is all there is, or nature is all that exists. Yeah, if you're one of those atheists, then you would absolutely say that a causal reality, Platonic abstract objects, abstract moral values, that would be very clear. In fact, you probably regard that as virtually impossible, because that's just a completely different metaphysical category. But that's not what I am. That's not what I think. So there's nothing in my background knowledge that even makes it improbable.
I think this might be another way to vocalize your line of thought here, Jeff. So we're talking about prior probabilities in the case of the 0 to 100, and then also in with the flying saucer in our backyard. The reason why this doesn't really work is because, well, you said in the first case with the 0 to 100, we're talking about the principle of indifference that we're applying over the 0 to 100 numbers there. So it's a matter of our background knowledge. And then likewise, in the case of the flying saucer, it's also a case of our background knowledge conflicting with the existence of this flying saucer in our backyard. So there's this background knowledge that we've got to contend with. So even if we have no evidence, just because the fact that our background or the prior probability of this is so low, that's what's giving us the low probability, right? In the end, the evidence isn't doing any of the work. When we're looking at sort of Bayes factor, the Bayes factor isn't doing anything. It's basically the posterior probability is equal to the prior probability. And so what we're looking for is an argument for a low prior probability. Whereas Jeff is saying that, hey, I can agree that the evidence doesn't point us anything, doesn't increase the probability, doesn't decrease the probability, but we still need a sort of argument for a low prior probability. Because if the prior is high, or you know, at 0.5, we don't know what it is, or whatever you want to apply the prior probability, that's what the posterior is going to be. And so we need an argument for a low prior, I guess is the way. And you were nodding the whole time, so I guess you endorse that. So Wade, what are your thoughts?
Well, that's what I've been kind of giving this whole time. That's kind of what the argument from queerness is supposed to do, is kind of explain why we give these low prior probabilities to things that are substantially different from the types of things we normally experience. I mean, again, think of the invisible unicorn example. Now, that could have a higher prior probability if we had experience of, say, invisible unicorns. If I throw paint somewhere and there's the shape of a unicorn and it flies around that somewhere, then the prior probability that there's an invisible unicorn floating above my head isn't as unlikely. But the fact is that given our experience, we don't have anything really remotely like that in our experience. It's very different, wildly different from the types of things we experience and know about. That's what makes this prior probability low. And I think from
not to confuse words here. So let's think about a hypothetical situation. So imagine someone, an atheist, who has a good argument for mathematical Platonism, and that's in our background knowledge. In that case, would you say that the prior probability is still very low if we had some sort of argument like that in our background knowledge?
I'd say it's still pretty low. It might be slightly higher because at least we have maybe something somewhere in the ballpark, but we still have a lot of problems. Like, for example, we think this moral oughtness is associated with our actions somehow. Well, it could be associated with all sorts of other crazy stuff. And yet objective morality in particular for us, we believe is associated with our actions. So we still have that, like, you know, 1 in 100 thing. We believe objective moral oughtness is associated with human actions and not, say, you know, an arrangement of certain rocks on Mars, for example.
All right. So let's say, okay, well, sorry, Jeff, I'm using up all your time here. I just wanted to get, let me get this last thing out. But let's say that we didn't have any arguments in favor of like mathematical Platonism, or we just don't really know. If there are these sorts of arguments exist or whatever, would you say that automatically as a sort of default, we would apply a low prior simply because we don't know of anything else that exists like these moral properties? Would you say that that's just sort of the default position is going to be a low prior? Wade? That was to you. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking to Jeff.
Oh no, I was asking a question to you, but okay. It's along the same line, sort of continuing where I was before. Let me just repeat it real quickly. Should we apply if we don't know anything else about moral facts, or really anything remotely relevant or similar, like mathematical Platonic objects or whatever, is a low prior probability, is that going to be the default position according to you, or should we be more agnostic on it?
Given our other background knowledge of what we know exists, you know, like tables and chairs and people and whatnot, I think a low prior probability for objective morality would be appropriate.
All right, so I'm done. So Jeff, go ahead and take over now.
You're doing a great job. I'm happy to let you keep going. So I don't think it would be appropriate. And again, I want to make a distinction between generic prior probability and what philosopher Purdue University philosopher Paul Draper calls intrinsic probability. You can think of intrinsic probability as the mother of all prior probabilities. So normally when you talk about a prior probability, as a Bayesian, you're saying, well, there are certain facts I'm including in my background knowledge, like human beings exist, we live on a planet that's life-friendly, that sort of thing. That might be background knowledge. Intrinsic probability says what's the probability of a hypothesis totally apart from any extrinsic factors like evidence? Well, what would be left? If you can't, if you're not going to look at empirical evidence, what you're looking at is the hypothesis itself. What does it say? And the two things that you can look at are how much does it say, and how well does what it does say, how the different parts of what it say fits together. The first part, modesty, is clearly relevant to intrinsic probability because the more a hypothesis says, the riskier it is. The more it says, the more ways there are for the hypothesis to be wrong. So everything else held equal, modest hypotheses are intrinsically more probable than immodest hypotheses. The other criterion says, what's the coherence of the hypothesis? So if we split the hypothesis up into different parts, if one part is improbable on the other part or contradicts it, then that makes it less likely that the hypothesis is true. So coherent hypotheses are intrinsically more probable than incoherent or less coherent hypotheses. Apply this to objective morality. I think that the hypothesis that objective morality exists is, it's not maximally modest, but it's not maximally immodest. It's somewhere in the middle. If we look at coherence, I don't see, especially if you define morality as I do, so I'm not assuming that there's an unconditional imperative, because that, I think there are some questions about coherence, but if you define it as I do, I don't see a coherence issue. So the intrinsic probability of a moral Platonism, or I prefer the term moral anti-reductionism, is not low. It's not high. But it's certainly not low. I think what Wade's doing is saying, he's not thinking about intrinsic probability. He's saying, he wants to talk about prior probability, and he's saying, based on our background knowledge of what we do know exists, that what we know exists somehow makes it unlikely that something like moral Platonism could be true. And I'm not, frankly, I'm not sure how that argument is supposed to work. I mean, being as charitable as I can, if you are open-minded to claim that abstract objects exist, the key of an abstract object is that they don't stand in causal relations to anything else. So I'm not exactly sure how the fact that we have direct experience of the physical world is in any way informative about the claim that there exist other things that don't stand in causal relations to the physical world.
Well, not directly.
Please say more.
Okay. Well, not directly. No. My point is that prescriptive oughtness, that highly metaphysical stuff, it seems wildly different from the types of things that we actually experience. And I mean, I frankly find it a little bit arbitrary that we don't assign queerness to invisible, non-physical, more objectively existing oughtness, but we normally do to other physical things. Like if I say a ghost is inside my room right now, we would assume that the prior probability is low, to the point where if somebody said, oh, I saw a ghost, I'd be like, no, I don't think you probably didn't. And to me, it seems we have like some sort of objectively existing non-physical stuff, but not, you know, like we assign low prior probability to other objective non-physical stuff, but not objectively existing non-physical causally inert moral oughtness. Why? What's the justification for that?
Let me just add a little bit more clarification, because I think we're narrowing in on where the disagreement is. And so it's not about the intrinsic probability of the hypothesis. It's really about the background knowledge. What other sort of things we know apart from the hypothesis, apart from the evidence, what's sort of in our background knowledge? And so the background knowledge, Wade, what you're talking about here, is basically everything else that exists, which is all this physical stuff in the world and stuff that we interact with. And so it's not that the intrinsic probability of the hypothesis of objective morality existing, that's not really what's under discussion here. The thing that's doing the work to get that low prior probability is the background knowledge, the fact that we know that other physical stuff exists and we don't really have any evidence of any of these other objects or non-physical entities and that kind of thing. Does that sound fair?
Basically, the key point behind the argument from queerness is that, you know, non-physical objectively existing oughtness is very different from the types of things we know exist in a way to make its prior probability unlikely, akin to saying that a ghost is in the room.
Yeah, but it's so my point, just to clarify, is that it's not about the intrinsic probability of the hypothesis.
Yeah, it's very dependent on our background knowledge.
It's the background knowledge, right? It's the background. And that, there's a distinction there, right? There's a distinction between the intrinsic probability of a hypothesis and then just the other stuff that we know about that's the sort of unrelated, which in this case, what's unrelated, but it's also related. But it is the background knowledge. It's not the intrinsic probability. And so we can, Wade, rather, can grant that the intrinsic probability of objective morality is, you know, either inscrutable or we just don't know. Maybe it's 0.5, we don't know, but it's the background knowledge that's really doing all this work. And so I guess the question is, how is it doing that? Wade, what you've said is that it's because we know of all this other stuff, physical reality, that everything else that we know that exists is completely unlike objective morality, and so, or at least on atheism. And so that's what's giving us this low prior.
Yep.
So Jeff, back to you. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, so, it's interesting because when we, if I heard him correctly, I love his clarity. So I want to compliment him. He gave the example of ghosts, and he said, why is it that ghosts have a low prior probability, but abstract objects like objective moral values would not have a low prior probability? And I think he even said there seems to be arbitrariness about how we're doing that. And my response to that is very simple. Ghosts are part of causal reality. So this is why that diagram at the beginning is so important. If a ghost actually existed, one of its properties is the ability to enter into causal relations. And because it has, according to its hypothesis, causal powers, that makes it possible to actually construct a logically correct inductive argument against the existence of ghosts. We know that, at least with respect to human minds, that consciousness is dependent upon the physical brain. And that's much more likely on the assumption naturalism is true, and that dualism is false, than it is on the assumption that theism is true, or supernaturalism is true, and dualism, or even dualist interactionism is true. The key point here is that ghosts can stand in causal relations. Abstract objects can't. So I don't think that the arbitrariness objection works. I think there may be some other area of disagreement between us, but I don't think that we're arbitrary. You might say, I don't like your argument against ghosts, and that's fine. We could certainly talk about that. But there's definitely, it's definitely not an arbitrary objection. There is a consistency in the reasoning.
I would like to do this. I think this might be interesting to do if we have time for it. Wade, I wanted to see if you could summarize what Jeff's response was here so that we can all make sure that we're understanding, everyone's on the same page. And then when you summarize it, we'll get Jeff to say yes or no, and then we'll move to your response. I think that would be appropriate because I'm still trying to process and understand, Jeff, what you're saying, because it's based on your sort of the presentation that you gave at the beginning. I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page. Before we do that, Jeff, if you wouldn't mind, would you mind turning your video off? I want to see if, because we're getting some, your audio is a little crunchy. It sounds a little scratchy. So I'm thinking if we turn off your video, it might clear up your audio a little bit.
I could barely make it out myself. I heard that about the only thing I could make out is something about a relevant difference is that ghosts stand in causal relations, but abstract objects don't. And that somehow is supposed to make the abstract moral oughtness, non-physical objectively existing prescriptive moral oughtness, more likely because it's acausal. I don't see why that's relevant. I mean, imagine if I say, okay, there's a ghost in my room, but it can't cause anything.
Before we go forward, Jeff, was that your response? Did you say that?
That's I said that the... No. Is my audio any better?
You're still showing your video.
Yeah, if you can just at the top of the screen, just hit the turn camera off. There you go. Okay, let's see if that clears your audio up.
Yeah. Any better?
It might be a little better. But yeah, so let's hear your response one more time, and then we'll move it back over to Wade.
Okay. But I apologize for the audio. Maybe if I crouch over and get closer to my microphone, is that improvement?
No, I think it's a bandwidth issue or something like that. So I don't think it's distance from the mic or anything.
Okay. Okay. He raised an arbitrariness objection. He said, why do ghosts have a low prior probability? Abstract objects don't. Ghosts have a low prior probability because ghosts, if they exist, would be part of causal reality, stand in causal relations. And that's important because the claim of ghosts is that they can exist without a physical brain. However, the evidence that we have, at least with respect to human minds, is that the human mind is dependent upon a physical brain. And so that gives us some reason to believe that minds also need a physical brain if they're going to exist. And so that reason is why we think that ghosts have a low prior probability. I don't know how that's in any way relevant to abstract objects. The point here is not that anything I've said makes the existence of abstract objects high, probability being high. Rather, I think that the probability is inscrutable.
Your camera's still on.
Yeah, it seems like when you turn your camera off, it pops back on. I don't know if that's intentional or not, but I think that I heard the objection one more time. And I think I'm clear on it, and I think Wade might be, hopefully he's clear on it as well. So let's turn it back over to you, Wade.
The sound was kind of breaking up on me too, so I couldn't really determine what he was saying. But like I said, so he said that we have evidence that minds need a brain. Well, what's our evidence exactly? Is it because we don't have any instances of that happening? Is it because that would be different from the types of things we've normally experienced? Because then that just falls right under what my objection is, namely that non-physical moral oughtness is wildly different from the types of things. Mind-brain dependence is evidence. Well, again, what's our evidence that it is dependent on it, that it requires a physical? It's because we haven't had experience with it. Because then, again, our lack of experience of invisible, non-physical, objectively existing moral oughtness, you know, we don't have any evidence for it. And it's very different from the types of things we know exist. I mean, that does seem to be under the same sort of thing. We seem to have the same sort of problem. And if causal relations are an issue, okay, let's just say that the ghost doesn't cause anything. Suppose we have an acausal ghost or spirit that's in my house right now. It still seems to have the same problem. And if you turn off your video, you know where that turn camera off thing is?
Google Hangout? Yeah, he's done that a couple times, and it keeps popping back up. I don't know if that's something that he's doing. But what you can do is you can adjust your bandwidth usage, Jeff.
I'm not doing it, guys. I'm sorry it keeps doing it.
Okay. If you lower your bandwidth, it might help with your audio. There's a bandwidth button up at the top of the screen next to the video. I'd rather not do this in text. I mean, I can hear Jeff. Wade, you're saying that you can't?
Not right now. I think he's got it muted. But yeah, there's a turn camera off button in there.
He's got it. He's got his camera off now. But Jeff, let's turn it back over to you if we can get your response there to Wade.
Yeah. I don't have it memorized, and of course I'll find it right after we hang up. But in my debates on God's existence on my blog posts, I standardly present five lines of evidence for mind-brain dependence, and they're positive statements. They're not the negative statement that, well, we just don't have any evidence of minds existing apart from brains. So I wasn't prepared to talk about that. I don't have it memorized. But the key point here is that when I defend the claim of mind-brain dependence, I'm not in any way appealing to lack of evidence for mind-brain independence. That the lack of evidence part does zero work in my argument.
Yeah, maybe instead of going down this rabbit trail, maybe we can actually, Wade, you're good at giving examples. Maybe we can discuss a different example.
All right.
Unless you thought that the one with the aliens was appropriate, and we can just narrow in on that.
Well, yeah, I'm trying to think of something otherworldly because that's kind of what it applies here. I mean, so I'm really baffled why it seems very arbitrary to me why or other non-physical stuff is unlikely, but other objectively existing non-physical stuff. All right. Okay. How about clairvoyance? You know, somebody somewhere claims they have clairvoyant properties. That seems, you know, far-fetched. I mean, that's almost basically the only way we'd know on atheism that moral logic exists, because we need some sort of supernatural intervention. Somebody says they have supernatural clairvoyance, that they have this power, but we don't have any evidence for it. We give a low prior probability for that.
So by clairvoyance, you mean they can tell the future?
No, that's precognition. Clairvoyance is that you just know stuff out there of reality without being able to detect it physically.
What about, we could use that or precognition. I almost think that might be interesting to think about as well. Either one. I'm cool with looking at. So you would say, Wade, that on either one of those, and I'm just assuming here that you would say the same for precognition, which is basically just being able to tell the future, that would, we'd apply a low prior probability, based not because it's intrinsically improbable, but because of our background knowledge, because of what we know about, I guess, humans normally can't do that, or the people that have claimed it have not been able to tell the future. How would you, what would you say, what part of our background knowledge is doing all that work to give us the low prior probability?
Well, it's still using the same sort of reasoning as the argument from queerness. It's very different from the types of things we know exists.
Okay, and so that's enough in your mind to give us a low prior probability.
Yeah, wildly different from the sort of things we know exists, like ghosts, like invisible unicorns, etc.
So wildly different, and that gives us a low prior. So Jeff.
So, I guess, I'm trying to be concise. Yes, they are different from the things that we know to exist in physical reality, but a key part of the hypothesis of abstract objects, or as I call it, a causal reality, is that they can't stand in causal relations. So it's actually built into the concept of an abstract object that we wouldn't have empirical evidence of existing, even if it existed, because it's not, depending on how you define the word empirical, but it would not be an empirical hypothesis certainly in the ordinary sense of the term empirical. It's not something that exists physically, so it wouldn't be empirically detectable. So, you know how earlier you were talking about how if atheistic naturalism is true, and were the results of evolution, we would probably have the moral beliefs that we have, whether or not they were true. Similarly, there's a parallel concept with abstract objects. Whether abstract objects exist or not, we would still have the same amount of empirical evidence for them existing. So the fact that we don't have such empirical evidence doesn't really seem, it's not surprising on the hypothesis that abstract objects exist. That's not what they claim. Whereas something like a ghost or even clairvoyance, you could actually make empirical tests of that claim or that hypothesis. There is no empirical test for an abstract object. That's a category error. So again, does this mean that there is a high probability that they exist? No, absolutely not. I'm just saying it doesn't mean that there's a low probability either. I think the rational conclusion is that the probability is inscrutable and that we should be agnostic about whether or not abstract objects exist.
So why be agnostic about abstract objects, which I'm still not convinced of? I think if we don't have any reason to believe them, they're queer in a way to believe that we're justified in believing they probably don't exist. Why be agnostic here and be skeptical, think that he probably doesn't have supernatural clairvoyant powers in this case?
Sorry, my audio cut out. I have to catch the second part.
All right. So we would ordinarily give a low prior probability to the supernatural clairvoyant claim. But, you know, I actually think if we have no reason to believe in abstract objects, we should give a low prior probability to their existence. But that aside, even if that were true, why should we have a moderate prior probability for abstract objects, but a low prior probability for the claim of supernatural clairvoyant powers?
That's an interesting question. So I'll be honest with you, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about the hypothesis of clairvoyance. I know that my knee-jerk reaction is, with that hypothesis, because there is the possibility of empirical testing, the prior probability isn't actually as interesting or important to me, because regardless of what its prior probability is, I'm sure you're familiar with the expression of swamping of the priors. I think that we could actually accumulate enough empirical evidence that even if we gave clairvoyance a prior probability of 0.5 or 0.9, ultimately the repeated failure of the hypothesis to be verified by empirical tests, that would swamp out the prior. It wouldn't matter. So does it have a low prior probability? I don't know. I don't know that I need to make that claim. All I know is I think it's false. And the reason I think it's false is primarily because the hypothesis doesn't seem to do any work. It doesn't actually work.
Doesn't work? So why would that not work, but non-physical moral oughtness that we have no reason to believe, why would that work?
So I'm not making the claim that abstract objects are an explanatory hypothesis.
Well, okay, but there seems like there should be some non-arbitrary reason. If we're to reject the claim that non-physical objectively existing oughtness is not queer on the atheist point of view, it seems like we should have some justification why that's not the case here, but we would ordinarily apply queerness to these other.
Right. So again, an atheist, qua atheist, simply says there is no God. They don't say anything about whether or not ghosts exist or abstract objects exist.
Right. But that's why I had that K in the probability statement.
You go to the next category out, you say, okay, become a metaphysical naturalist. And as far as causal reality exists, the physical has ontological priority over the mental. Again, even source physicalism or naturalism doesn't say anything about that. So it's not that the source physicalist says that there's a high probability. There's no basis for saying, based on what we do know about physical causal reality, what may or may not exist in a causal reality.
I think this is something that Jeff could say. And this is just going to underline something I think that is current, or it's a perennial problem in Bayesianism, is this difference, or not necessarily difference, but so how do we actually calculate the prior probability of something? I think that's something that philosophers are working on, and there's no real like one way of going about doing it. And so it sounds to me like it's just a difference in methodology here. It's like Wade is saying, hey, we can calculate the prior probability this way. And then Jeff could just say, well, I don't really think that that's a good way of calculating the prior probability. I think we actually calculate it this way. And so it'd be a difference of methodology. And then, you know, where do we go from there? Is there a way to like say that, hey, this is objectively the way that we should calculate this prior? I mean, if we could do that, then we should be writing papers in philosophy and letting everyone know, hey, we've solved this huge problem in Bayesianism. So I don't know. That's just something that strikes me as I'm listening to this conversation go about. What do you guys think about that?
Well, let's say, okay, so I'm using an argument from queerness. So Jeff, do you agree with the general idea that if given our background knowledge, some entity, some hypothesized entity is wildly different from the stuff that's in our background knowledge, that ceteris paribus would have a low prior probability?
Ceteris paribus, yeah, I think so.
Okay, so it doesn't sound like we disagree
on
the
general principle. Hold on, let me think just a second. I may have been too quick. Let me think for just a second. Wildly different from everything else that we know in our background knowledge. Probability.
Yeah, so an example of what I mean by wildly different from the types of things we know exist. It'd be things like, you know, there's an invisible dragon in my garage, or there's a ghost in my room, or a flying saucer landed on my backyard, that sort of thing.
Yeah, ceteris paribus. And so then the obvious follow-up to that I would make is that things are not equal, because you're, it'd be like saying, my knowledge of astronomy is quite limited, but trying to make some points about ordinary baryonic matter and trying to use that as an argument against the existence of dark energy when, or dark matter, when if there is such a thing as dark matter, its properties are totally different. So it's not going to make the same kind of empirical predictions that an ordinary, you know, baryonic matter hypothesis would have. Same thing with abstract objects. If abstract objects exist, by definition, we would not expect to have that kind of empirical evidence.
Well, the same would hold an invisible dragon spewing heatless fire in my garage too. We wouldn't expect to have evidence for its existence, but I'd still think it's clear enough to make it prima facie.
Right. So I think a key difference between you and I is that you put a huge amount of emphasis on the heavy lifting or alleged heavy lifting that you think the lack of evidence does. Whereas for me,
that's not quite true.
Okay, fair enough. For me, that has almost no relevance at all. A lot of atheists will say there's a lack of evidence for God's existence. Whether or not that's true, and I actually think it's false, I think there is some evidence for God. The more important point is that I think there's evidence against God's existence. An invisible dragon, even if by definition we wouldn't have evidence, really what that means is we wouldn't have visual evidence. It doesn't mean that we would have literally no evidence. We could still have auditory evidence touch evidence, smell, taste, whatever. There are positive reasons to doubt the existence of an invisible dragon that have nothing to do with whether or not there's a lack of evidence. So I do think, I'm not sure that ultimately resolves anything for this debate, but it just occurred to me that that's a fundamental difference. You put a lot of emphasis on alleged lack of evidence, whereas for me, I don't focus on that so much at all.
That's not where it is. It's not just the fact that we have a lack of evidence. It's relation between the claim and our background knowledge, such that the claim is wildly different from the types of things we know exist. That's why I use the example of an invisible dragon spewing heatless fire in my garage. Because it's not just the fact that we don't have evidence for it. It's also the idea that it's very much different from the types of things we know exist. That is a relationship that justifies its low prior probability.
So one thing we haven't talked about is how theism, we've kind of focused on how this looks from an atheistic point of view. Pretend that we're all theists. What in our background knowledge makes the existence of abstract objects any more likely than it would be on atheism? Yeah, I mean, obviously they're not physical, so you've got that going for you. But the fact remains that even supernatural beings like God have the ability to stand in causal relations, and they are able to interact with the physical world in ways that, if they choose to do that, whether it's a miracle or something else, at least in theory, are empirically detectable. None of that is the case with an abstract object. So I'm happy to keep talking about what it looks like from an atheist point of view. I go back to one of my original claims, which is that I don't see how adding God's existence into the equation actually helps anything.
That depends on your theology about what God is. So, for example, I think of God as this supremely authoritative, ought-to-be-obeyed entity, in which case the prescript of it would actually be entailed by God's existence. But, of course, if you had a different theology, that might not apply.
That's interesting. I think that's a fair point. What I would say is that if you go that route, I don't think that's arbitrary at all. But what I would say is that in that case, theism isn't really explaining why there is objective morality rather than no objective morality at all. Instead, theism just assumes your theism assumes, not explains, the existence of objective morality.
Wait, yeah, I was going to say your mic is muted.
All right, so, well, depending on your theology, God's existence entails the existence of objective morality because God is morally good, and presumably he's morally good independently of whether we think he is. And on many people's theology like mine, God has a supremely authoritative ought to be obeyed concept, in which case his existence would entail the prescriptive ought. But I guess, should we wrap things up a bit, like kind of summarize our positions?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, we could go and talk about these issues and these questions all day long, and I think that we probably could if we had time to. I mentioned before we came on the air, I mentioned that I'm having a baby, or my wife is, we are, having a baby on Monday, and so we've got to wrap up some of the stuff that we're getting set up in the room and everything. So, yeah, why don't we go ahead and close the discussion out. Let's do it with giving some sort of summary statement about what you thought of the conversation, how it's gone, some of the points that stuck out for you, and where you're currently sitting on the dialogue, and then yeah, and then we'll close it out. So, who wants to go first? Anybody? Let's do Wade. If you wanna go first, and then Jeff, you can close it out.
All right. So, share. All right, so where is that? I probably should have had these things numbered. Aha. All right, so here's a summary for the inductive argument. I'm claiming that the unbiased atheist will be justified in thinking that objective morality probably doesn't exist. Now, the reasons collectively are there's zero empirical evidence for objective morality. Objective moral properties are suspiciously queer in a way that make them unlikely to exist. They're low prior probability. Evolution occasionally gives false beliefs, like God's. Moral beliefs have survival value, whether true or not. People would have moral beliefs even if morality did not exist. Five is important because it means we don't really have any reason to believe that morality exists if atheism is true. Our main disputable point here is line two here. I think that invisible, non-physical, objectively existing moral oddness is queer to make it unlikely to exist on atheism. And Jeff disagrees with that. And so, again, the general approach, of course, is that objective morality's existence is unlikely on atheism. And two is that point where we primarily dispute. So that's it in a nutshell.
All right, so let's move on to Jeff. And if you want to pull up any of your slides, feel free to do so. And yeah, take it away.
First of all, thanks for having me, Cameron, and congratulations in advance on your new arrival. I'm the dad myself, and I think that's awesome. It's nice to meet you for the first time, and it's also nice to meet you for the first time, Wade. I've really enjoyed the conversation. And I'd like to compliment Wade again for his clarity. I think that his presentation and his comments are very insightful. Though I obviously disagree with him, I really appreciate the depth of thought and clarity, because I think all three of us could agree that on topics like this, there are a lot of times people may try to make a point, but they don't do it in a very good way. And I just want to compliment Wade, because I think that he's done a really good job of defending his point of view in a way that's clear. I think that I would sum up my position as follows. William Lane Craig's argument is an argument about moral ontology, about the existence of objective moral values. And the key point in his argument is that if God does not exist, objective moral values do not exist. The focus is on existence. And Wade's comment today, although they're different from William Lane Craig's argument, and in my opinion, an improvement, so that's another compliment, Wade. I think that ultimately, I think both Craig and to a lesser extent, Wade have it backwards. I don't think that there is a good argument, deductive or inductive, from moral ontology to God's existence. I think that if God does not exist, all that tells us about moral ontology is that explicitly theistic claims like divine command theory or modified divine command theory are false. It doesn't tell us whether or not objective moral values exist. I think that the most interesting meta-ethical implications of atheism versus theism is that completely opposite of what William Lane Craig says, I think that atheism provides a defeater for believing, for the most common argument for believing in objective moral values. The most common argument for believing in moral values is the fact that it just seems like they exist, and ordinary people, when they talk, presuppose that they exist. And the defeater that naturalistic atheism provides that is that we're the products of evolution, unguided evolution, and so we would have that belief regardless of whether or not objective moral values exist. So atheism provides a defeater. We don't, atheists may not be justified in believing that objective moral values exist, but I don't think we can make the additional claim or leap to say that not only are they not justified in believing in them, but they're justified in believing that they don't exist. I think that's the key difference between Wei and I. And with that, I'll hand it over to you.
Awesome. Well, I wanted to thank both of you guys for coming on. I know that with Wade, I've tried to set up a few different shows to have him come on. So I'm glad that we were actually able to work it out. And thanks for your comments, Jeff, about the new baby. His name is Hendrix. Everything looks like he's going to be a healthy little boy. So we're stoked. But I thought this was an awesome discussion. The moral argument is something that for me, and I mentioned this before we started recording, is that I'm still a little skeptical about the first premise of the moral argument. After I had kids, I became completely convinced of the second premise, and that would be an interesting discussion in and of itself. But the first premise is something that I'm still working through after a few years of being in this. And so, I really enjoyed the discussion. Jeff, you're the perfect type of atheist, very friendly. You're knowledgeable. It seems like you take philosophy seriously. And I don't know what all your background is and everything, but I've really, really enjoyed the discussion. So I can tell you for a fact that I'll be reaching out to you again to have another discussion on another topic. And I know that I have seen some of your work in the resurrection, and so we might try to do a show on something related to that. But to both of you guys, thanks again for coming on. And just one last thing, if you guys have been enjoying these discussions on Capturing Christianity on the channel, hit the subscribe link on YouTube. This is the only way that you can watch the show is on YouTube. So if you're there watching it, hit subscribe, like the video, comment, do whatever you want to do. If you want to get in contact with me again, just check us out on the website or Facebook or Twitter, however you want to get in contact with us. Suggest future shows, suggest future people to come on. And with that being said, we'll see you guys next time.